The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Ireland's saving specialists. Rabodirect, the straight-talking savings bank.
Anyway, let us move along. My guest this morning has already had four careers. The youngest TD to be elected to the Dáil. He was already a farmer at that stage in Wexford. He later left politics to focus on his passion, which was bookmaking. And along the way, he also became a very popular pundit and radio presenter. But it was not all plain sailing as Ivan Yates' business hit the rocks and he was pursued in a serious fashion by his bank, AIB. Now, and he also became, I suppose, the highest profile bankruptcy exile. Ivan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Marion. I'm exhausted listening to all that.
Just looking at a couple of the headlines there today, you know, that Kenny hasn't managed to quell the anger, that, you know, the water thing was just a disaster. There are people marching. This was against the greatest success ever for Fine Gael electorally, one would have thought. Are you glad you're shut of it?
Yeah, no, politics is a tough life and frontline politics is stressful, it's exhausting. And the truth of it is, and I try and outline this in the book, when I was on the Council of Europe with other agricultural ministers, when I told them that I had to go home and do clinics at the weekend and constituency work, they had all that delegated. Someone stepped into their parliamentary shoes while they're a minister. And, you know, the type of demands, like, say you'd have a clinic on a Saturday morning in Enniscorthy. Say you were an average TD, you might have 20 people at it. When you're a minister, you could have 80 people at it. And, you know, so the pressures are doubled. Every people who never vote for you come and see you. So it's an exhausting life. And actually, ministers, their whole schedule is just crazy. The civil servants work them round the clock so that they just do things almost by rote on autopilot, key decisions. They don't get time to think.
They don't get time to think. And you also say that the absolute number one priority for every TD is to get re-elected.
Yeah, Chris Glennon, the old sage guy from NACE, who was political editor with the Indo, said there are two commandments, Ivan, in politics. Man or woman, get thyself elected and hold thy seat. And everything else is secondary.
Isn't that kind of shocking?
Well, I can understand in one way. If you give up a job, maybe say you're working in the private sector, you don't have a job to go back to necessarily. Maybe teachers do and so on. So it's all in on the river card there. I mean, like you don't have a lot of options. Your whole lifestyle, like it's not a job, a TD's job. It's a way of life. It's 24/7. You can't go down the street and say, Mrs. Murphy, sorry, it's a Saturday. I'm not going to talk to you about your medical card. But there is no doubt that I really believe strongly our electoral system is a disaster. I think the Dáil is full of glorified county councillors. And I think that's fine. I think half the Dáil should be elected that way and half should be a list system. So if party X gets 20% of the vote, say their top seven will get in or something like that. And they could be experts in tax, in the economy, in criminal law, in social justice or whatever. What you end up getting is people pleasers.
And that's what is essential. Though, there was a lot of talk around the time there was a heave against Enda Kenny about the fact that Alan Chatter and James Riley and Phil Hogan were very supportive. And it was therefore automatically assumed they would be given jobs.
Yeah, I try and outline the climbing of the greasy pole. Once you get in the Dáil, how you've got to be close to the leader. And we went through, in my time in Fine Gael, leadership heaves post-Garrett with Jukes and with Bruton and all of that stuff and ultimately with Noonan. And look, it was the maths was always very simple, Marion. There were only six FG slots in cabinet. And so on the front bench, there could be 18 people. So work it out. You know, you had to be part of the kitchen cabinet to be guaranteed a place.
Yes. Now, you were livid with Alan Jukes when he didn't give you a job.
Well, I was very trusting in those days. And I write it exactly as it was. Garrett had stepped down and we had gone through a difficult period, 86, 87, and I had been on the back benches and I was eyeing up the day Garrett was going to go. And I went to Jukes and I said, you know what? The entire former cabinet is going to back Peter Barry. But I said, there's a class of 81 of backbenchers that are going to have their say. And I think you're ideal. And I liked Jukes. I still like Jukes. And I was his biggest fan. And so then I remember Alan Shatter and Gay Mitchell, and we had this cabal, and we won against all the odds. He became leader. And people say it was the wrong thing, it was the wrong time. So jokingly, I said to him, well, you don't owe me anything. And I remember there was a rugby match on. I went off to Lansdowne Road. I didn't go to the celebrations in Kildare, and I outline this in the book. And then he appointed his front bench the next Tuesday, and none of his key supporters were put on the front bench. In fact, all the people, if Peter Barry had won, were reappointed. So I was flabbergasted.
Yeah, I can understand disappointment.
It was good to get.
and I can understand ambition. But it seems to me that no part of thinking was who was the best qualified.
Oh, no, I thought he would make the best leader. But I'd make a good front bencher too.
Yes, but in the business of appointing ministerial jobs or front bench jobs.
There would be a bit of talent. There'd be geography, there'd be gender, and there would be talent, but there would be loyalty.
Yeah, but why should you get a job because you were loyal?
Because when the going gets tough, the Taoiseach has to be sure that people will cover his back.
But that's only politics.
No, that's
what
really
about
important
the country?
In politics. Sorry, that would be true in the UK and the US and everywhere.
But what about the country going first?
Well, no, I mean, like, politics is a team game. Politics is a team game.
Well, having read that, it's the most divided team in the history of teamwork.
Which?
Having read your book, if that's what teams are.
I know. There would be collegiality, but obviously the jockeying for position. And this would be true in all parties. I mean, you take in the Fianna Fáil front bench in opposition. You know, if Micheál Martin became Taoiseach or Taoiseach or whatever, you know, he'll only have so many slots. And it's how close you are and to the leader will determine that.
But I would have thought that maybe it was up to the leader to assess the performance of the contenders and to choose the person that I thought, if I were a leader, had the best ability.
Mary, God love you. If you go into the jungle and you're carrying a machete and the guys behind you are carrying a machete, you don't want them to stick the machete in your back.
But that sounds like all one is interested in is in survival.
But sure, everyone who's in the high level of politics wants to be leader, perhaps.
Yeah, but
you've
what
got
about
to get
the
realistic
good of
about
the country?
All this. Oh, no, sir. All, no, public service is nothing. No, but sorry, you can be ruthless, ambitious and loyal and clever, but you can also be able. I mean, it's not these are not disqualifying.
Mutually exclusive. Yeah. No, well, I accept that.
So I think the point of this book, different to other books, is it tries to tell it from the insider perspective, what's really like. Oh. Like, I'm not going back to politics. So it's not written as a sugar-coated version of what it tells you through. And actually, the person who comes worst out of the book is me, because I'm on the make and on the take and ambitious and ruthless. And everything is, you know, my handling of the media when I was in the health portfolio. I manipulated stories to maximise my own profile. And so that's, but I'm trying to give people, actually it's written as a DIY guide, how to get in and how to get on in politics.
Right. Actually, some of it I thought would be how to get out, because it doesn't sound like a great life. It doesn't.
Well, no, well, I did write the chapter then, Losing the Faith.
Did people stay too long?
I always said, when I went in, like, my story is remarkable. I had no political background. I came home to farm. And I wrote away. I knew I wasn't a socialist. I knew no one belonging to me was in the GPO in 1916. So that ruled out Labour and Fianna Fáil, respectively. Garrett was jet-propelling Fine Gael after a disastrous election in 77. And I was at home, farming and bored in the long evenings. And I picked up the Yellow Pages. Had been at boarding school since the age of eight. And looked up Fine Gael in the Yellow Pages, wrote away to Waterford. And within 3 years, ended up in the Dáil. I got onto the council because they wanted a young Fine Gael candidate to put on it. So it was a remarkable odyssey. And I actually didn't know, because I was barely driving. I was 21. I didn't know how to get to the Dáil. I'd never been there. The traffic and all that was. But I kind of said to myself, you know, I'd be walking up and down the fields and they said, young Yeats, well, he can't be blamed for everything, and Wexford was a five-seater, made into a four-seater, made into a five-seater. There was a great opportunity in 81. I said, they mightn't ask me again. And, you know, my attitude going to the council is I haven't a prayer of getting in, but if I might get in the next time, get my foot on the ladder. So I was just in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, well, and obviously you worked your back off to do it. But if you look at that headline today about the 200,000 to the local soccer club, That's exactly what you think it should be.
No, no, sorry. That's exactly what I did. I tell the story how I got the Tour de France for Wexford. I don't know if you read that story. How I got the Johnstown Castle. All the Department of Agriculture was beside the Dáil. And there was they wanted to do to take it over for committee meetings and for offices and so on and build a tunnel. So they came to me and I said, no, no, no. I said, the civil servants won't wear this. And Albert Reynolds promised to move the whole department to Cork and they stymied it. So they said, Rory Quinn said, how would you feel if we were to move all the jobs to Johnstown Castle in your constituency? So then I went back to the civil servants and I said, I'm very sorry, I fought the good fight here, but it's a fait accompli, it's a cabinet decision, this has to go ahead. And 400 jobs are there, EPA, Department of Agriculture, decentralised to Johnstown Castle. So I tell all these stories.
This drives people around the bend, you know.
But I'm just trying to give an insight to the way it works.
Yep.
Sorry, I'm not condoning it. Sorry, the extent to which the parish pump and clientelism is a cancer in Irish politics needs to be exposed. I totally agree with that sentiment. And that's why I'm saying only half the Dáil should be made up of glorified county councils. I bet you, when Enda Kenny wakes up in the morning, the first thing he thinks about is Castlebar. And that's the way the DNA of politicians works.
And clowns like us think that he wakes up in the morning thinking about the good of the country.
Well, no, sir, of course he does. Of course he does. But look, you go into liquidation in this business if you lose your seat. Simple as.
Mm. Yeah.
So therefore, don't lose your seat and use the power to deliver to your constituency.
You know, with all the marching and the water and all of that. And there again, Phil Hogan got that job. Well, he got the European job and he got that job because of his support for Enda Kenny. And I know he's a good friend.
Yeah,
of yours,
he's a close friend of mine. Yeah.
He made an absolute hash of it.
Oh, and I told him that. I told him that months ago and he didn't appreciate me telling him that. I told him, you know, and he did reform of local government. But Phil, I knew for some time his heart was set on being commissioner. And I'd say to his discredit, I think he's very, very tough guy. But I think he knew that he wasn't going to be standing in the next election. And it allowed him to be quite boorish in his attitude to it. And I don't think it was PR savvy. And I would be critical of Phil of that. But I think he'd make a very good commissioner because he is well able to say to people, hump off. And while it's totally inappropriate in some circumstances, in other circumstances, in politics, the most important characteristic is courage.
Yeah, but if you take that business now of the redundancies that are going to be in Irish Water and the people that moved over from the county.
But that was ridiculous. I mean, like, that's the HSE was set up. The HSE is a good idea. You get single source of purchasing, you drive down prices, you drive efficiency. But what did Bertie do? He signed up a deal that everyone had to be held onto their job. So getting rid of 8 health boards, you kept all the layers of administration. Exact same. You have 34 local authorities. I wrote this some time ago, that it's HSE all over again insofar as that everyone was guaranteed a job for 12 years.
Right. And Phil's attitude was, I don't micromanage.
Well, I'd say there was an element of Labour and the unions to get this through. They actually forgot about the public and they said, what we've got to do at all costs is keep the IR side of this happy. And I think they misread that. But actually, John Fitzgerald has done great work saying 2,400 is adequate instead of 4,000 staff. So they are going to be supernumerary at the end of the day.
Right. So anyway, you're not missing it. What did you think of James Riley, that other person, as Minister for Health?
He was one of the worst ever.
Because he supported Kenny.
It was a former president of the IMO, and I actually think Kenny and Gilmore said, oh, he's a doctor, he knows about all this stuff. And universal health insurance, I was writing about this for ages, that it just was never going to work. Who was going to employ 97,000 people in the HSE? Was it VHI? Was it Leia? Was it Lowe? Nobody thought about these things. And actually, I honestly believe in an NHS model. I think it can drive efficiencies, it can take on the vested interests, but it's never been allowed to work in a proper fashion.
Right. Well, we'll see if it will or if it won't. You've been through your own difficulties, shall we say, yourself. And I read, at one stage, the valuation of your business was 180 million, which is...
No, that was the turnover.
The turnover was 180 million. And the value was...
A banker sat me down in Rowley's Bistro in 2006 and said, Ivan, you've only one problem. And I said, what's that? He said, your business is making 80 grand a week, Celtic Bookmakers, 4 million a year, EBITDA. We value that times 8. That's 32. Your farm has now been completely rezoned. DNG have done a valuation on that and they say it's worth 25 million. It could build 2,000 houses. So whatever way you go, Ivan, 25 plus 30, you're worth 50 million. So I said, OK, what's my problem? You've no borrowings, Ivan. So he solved my problem. So that was the culture of the time. But I had no diversification. I never got into the property game. All my shops were leasehold. But what happened was I carried out with bank debts two major acquisitions. I bought Joe Malloy Bookmakers and I bought Ubet and I paid too much for them. I paid the Celtic Tiger rates and I had Celtic Tiger rents. And basically when the crash hit, disposable income, they had to buy clothes, people, they had to buy food, but they didn't have to have a bet. And turnover dropped by 40%. And there was a movement to online betting. 25 years ago, Marianne, 90% of all bets in Ireland were over the counter of a betting shop. I'd say in 5 years' time, 90% of all bets in Ireland will be online. So that was the other factor. So those
did you
two,
not see that coming?
No, I did see it coming, and not to the extent. But my problem was, I was approached by two guys who had a really good track record, and they said, let's set up CelticBookmakers.com. So I said, go away, produce a business plan. They came back, said, to do this right, marketing, cost of client acquisition, it's going to cost 10 million. I didn't have 10 million, Marianne. Right. And they had no money. So I said, maybe I should stick to the knitting, what I'm doing, decent high street shops, 63 of them in Ireland and the UK. But obviously, that was a wrong judgment, right, and what I paid for business. And when all that followed, I had to take full responsibility for what was a tits up disaster.
So you say you were worth 50 million. How quickly did it evaporate?
Well, I was in the boardroom of William Hill in the first week of October 2008, and I had a deal on the line to sell the business for 13 million. The next week, Brian Lennon got up and announced the betting tax went up from 1% to 2%, and the bookmaker pays the tax. So our net margin was about 1.8%. So it was completely wiped out. And William Hill said, whoa, hold on a second. And they were going to introduce these roulette machines called fixed odds betting terminals. That never happened. So they ended up getting out of Ireland. So I outlined the journey of trying to get new investors into the business, to sell the business, to sell my shareholding in the business, to keep it going. And then I decided, with the help of NCB, here's 10 towns that Paddy Power aren't in and 30 towns Ladbrokes aren't in, to slice and dice the best shops and sell them. I just needed to get out for the debt. And it was like trying to catch a falling knife, insofar as that just each week the turnover was going down. And it
so
was very
2006
depressing.
Was
the best bit.
All systems
yeah.
go.
And 2007 wasn't too bad. It really started to jettison. I'll never forget it. It was the Builders' Holidays, because biggest betting week of the year, big Galway and Goodwood Racing Week, at Builders' Holidays in August. And suddenly I noticed, you know, like for like, the turnover wasn't rising anymore. And suddenly, guys off of building sites, 177,000 of them lost their jobs, would come into a betting shop and have 100 on a horse. They now weren't coming in at all, or only putting a fiver on a horse. And you know, I could actually name publicans who were our best customers disappearing because we had good tracking systems. So I could sense that's why I was trying to sell the business. I eventually just rang the bank when I ran out of road. When Ladbrokes pulled out, they said, we're not going to buy any shops. I rang the bank and I said, look, we need to invite a receiver in here, because while the business has value and has merit, and it's just illiquid. I can't sell it. And then we invited the receiver, and the receivership went well. 36 of the shops were sold. It raised a gross 3 million.
How much did you owe AIB?
About a total, just under 6 million. And so there was a net debt of about 3 million. And so then the receivership went well. The shops were either sold or closed. And then when it came a year later, look, there's nothing more to do here. We'll liquidate the company. You know, it was a dormant company at this stage. And then I got this letter from the bank saying, Celtic's debt is now your debt. And I had actually, we had a problem with road frontage on the land development. I bought a house which I never wanted, for 700,000. And I used all
Why
my savings.
Why did you buy a house?
Because to get road
want?
Frontage. To get
oh,
road.
Sorry,
to get
sorry,
road.
Sorry.
To, I had no road access. You wouldn't get planning permission. So I used all my savings. At this stage, I was broadcasting and earning money. All my savings, 800,000. I repaid the house. And what I didn't realise, when I got a new lawyer, in my personal guarantee, I'd given away this house. So I had actually no money. other than my pension. And so basically then I just said to the bank, I can't pay the 3 million. But I said, we had Bernard Summers, you know, was involved in our ice cream, pro bono basis, helped me, and we had several meetings. So I said, look, here's land I'll sell, 50 acres here. I'll sell this house that I bought, even though I've repaid that in full. And I'll tell you what, the final offer was, I said, when my mother dies, because she had a life interest for her lifetime, even though it's in my name, I'll give you 10% of my income until she dies, and I'll sell the rest when she dies, except the house. I wanted to keep the house. And basically, the whole thing just disintegrated. I went to the UK. Everyone said to me, Ivan, you need a negotiated outcome. I didn't want to go bankrupt at all. But they went to the High Court to try and bankrupt me. And we fought the case and we won the case. The court threw it out, the same judge that jailed Quinns and everybody else, because they'd never got a judgment against me. So basically, but at that stage, it was really toxic, the relationship between me and the bank. So then my lawyers rang me and said, look, Ivan, get a grip here. You're over in the UK. The reason they didn't get it was they went for too much money. If they went for a lower amount, Ivan, they're going to make you bankrupt. And you now have to make a decision whether you're going to go bankrupt in Wales or in Ireland. There is not going to be a negotiated settlement here. So I outline in the book how I'd maintained that I offered them 80 cent in the euro. And so now bankruptcy is pretty rough, whether you go bankrupt here or America.
You see, because of the high-profile people, including yourself, and the high-flying developers that, you know, went overseas to go bankrupt, there's a kind of a perception that, you know,
than a perception. I can tell you straight up, it's bankruptcy tourism, it's called, and all the rest of it. And I've never heard such bullshit in all my life, because the truth of it is, the rules of bankruptcy, you know, a lot of ignorance about this, and I'll be very frank about it. The day you go bankrupt, here's the deal. Everything you own, your wristwatch, your home, your property, is vested in the insolvency service. And they then appoint, on behalf of the bank, a trustee in bankruptcy. In my case, a really expensive one, Baker Tilly in London.
And who is paying for that?
I'll end up paying for it in terms of the sale of the realisation of the proceeds of my assets. And the deal is, the day you're discharged, all your debts evaporate. So it's like you died and this executor of your estate comes along and does. So the situation is, Baker Tilly will now sell everything that I own. But they have to, there's a stay because my mother's still alive. She's 82. So that's the deal. Now, whether you go bankrupt in Dublin or in Ireland, it actually makes no difference. Or in America, the same rules. You forfeit and you get your discharge. Now, if you don't cooperate, they go through every transaction in the previous 5 years. So if you shift money away, so I went through every process with the Director of Corporate Enforcement, need to say with the Revenue Commissioners, with the Insolvency Service, with the Trustee in Bankruptcy, and I never shifted any assets away, you know, hid anything. I said, look, my assets are very simple. Here's my pension. Here's my property in Enniscorthy. This is a very simple case. So they went through it exhaustively and so on, and they found I was telling the truth. So basically, they gave me my discharge on time. But the one thing it gave me, and was the only thing I ever wanted, was a fresh start. So I have no bankruptcy restriction order. I had no income payments order against me, and I can make a fresh start. But so I'm renting in Dublin, a house in Dublin. And basically, like, I'm 55 now. My wife, she's a teacher. We need to procure a home somewhere, you know, because I'm not, you know, the media business is a bit fickle and it won't go on forever. So basically what I'm trying to do is save up to get a home.
But do they not attach any of your income, like your pension or
there's particular rules about a pension. You are entitled to so much to live. So my net pension is about 34 grand a year. I'm entitled to live on that. But there are rules about a sovereign pension. I didn't know this till I got over there. The Working Pensions Act, whatever it is, 1998 or something like that. But basically, they're now coming after Deirdre. She's in the High Court. She signed the personal guarantee
wife,
as well.
Yes.
So, I mean, let's forget about Ivan for one second. People say to me, well, did you not know what you signed with a personal guarantee? And I was speaking at the insolvency dinner and I said, that's a great question. Because what is a personal guarantee? Is it your assets the day you sign it and your earnings? Or is it the assets and earnings the day they call in the guarantee? Or is it your assets and earnings not only both those days, but into the future? And if it's into the future, Marion, is it 6 months into the future? Is it 6 years into the future?
I thought it was 2 years based on your trip.
No. It's whatever your creditor says it is. And that can be forever. And it can be beyond the grave till the debt is cleared. And we need to reform the law on personal guarantees so that there's some limit. Let the politicians decide what that limit is. But at the moment, the law, you know, I mean, it leads to bad lending. And the other thing we need to do is we need to copy and paste the UK legislation, the 1986 Act. They have between 50 and 74,000 people every year go through the service. You know, it deals with every rogue creditor, defaulting debtor, and it works. Our system here doesn't work. And we should simply reform the law on PGs and we should copy and paste the UK, because that would allow people to deal with these legacy issues and move on.
The In terms of yourself, because you do write a lot about what your home in Enniscorthy meant to you, that it came down through the generations in the family. To what extent is this a business failure, or to what extent did it strike you as a personal failure?
Well, sure, there's no aspect of it is a total failure. It's both. I mean, insofar as that... My father died when I was a teenager, and part of the book is I outline how I never had an adult relationship with him, and he was my employer as well, a very tough man. And I'm actually quite a frugal person. I wear the same tatty old jumper that I would have worn 10 years ago. I'm quite happy with that. It's part of my Protestant frugality. So basically, I think a lot of people try and please their fathers. So you can imagine when he drilled into me, his father was Ivan Yates, his grandfather was John F. Yates, and I was the fifth generation there. And now I've kind of put all that in jeopardy and blown it. So that's difficult. Very difficult for my mother as well. So, and I feel that guilt very, very badly. Very, very badly. So that's one element of the failure. But, you know, you can kind of wallow in it, or you can kind of kick on, and so that's what I'm trying to do.
Right. And is it gone?
No, the situation is the trustee in bankruptcy cannot sell it, in my opinion, while my mother's alive. And there's some assets he can sell. And there was a meeting only last week about that, and they're pursuing Deirdre as well. So all that's in play. So it goes on. You don't get finality with it, really.
And tell me, when you were working on the radio, you're known obviously as a former minister and politician, and this was all going on in the background. Hard to keep up a front?
Well, that's one of the reasons I went. Like, emigrating in your 20s and 30s and going to the UK is a bit of an adventure. At 50? No. Married 4 kids? No, not a good idea. But the one plus was, in Swansea, if I had a pint, if I went wherever, you know what? Nobody knew who I was, cared who I was. The anonymity was wonderful. And therefore, that was the best side of it. It was desperately boring and lonely and sad and all that kind of thing. But that's why I wrote the book, to give me something to do. And it was quite fun because I wrote 170,000 words. And when I got back, I was speaking to people who knew about books, people like Terry Prone and Jonathan Williams and so on. They said, Ivan, you do realise only British prime ministers write books of more than 100,000 words. I said, why didn't you tell me that when I started? I could have saved a lot of work. So there was a lot of editing to be done on it subsequently.
Right. But nonetheless, I remember you doing interviews at the time when it went public. So you had been doing all these negotiations and seeing the cliff.
That was very difficult. And at the tail end of it, just before I left on Easter Monday in 2012, it became like they were actually running around a Good Friday, excuse me, trying to serve bankruptcy summonses on my mother. She was coming home from church, and I outlined that. And like, the whole thing, like, it's just like a fog and you just go through it. But like, I'm not looking for pity. You know, I'm a big boy. I took all these decisions, and I'd be as robust with the bank as they'd be with me. You know what I mean? I have to defend myself and my family. So my coping mechanism, because I described when I was minister in the BSE thing, how I had really a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
Because just I couldn't handle the stress and the work, and I was only sleeping. You know, I was coming into the department at 5 a.m. and I was working till late, and I wasn't eating properly. When it came to the bankruptcy, I learned to cope with stress. You know, I've done so much today. I met this lawyer. I've done this. I've got this strategy. I planned that. But there's nothing more I can do today about this. So I found, actually, I didn't suffer from the same nervous stress, but I was very depressed because I thought I'd never get out of it.
What'd your mum say to you?
Well, she had that all is slightly private insofar as that it's been very difficult. I've dragged my mother through the ditch backwards. Like, she supported my political career. Like, you know, you can imagine, her father was a clergyman, her grandfather was the Dean of Ferns. You know, like, she wouldn't really have approved of gambling. You know what I mean? You can imagine the type of lady she would be. So therefore, like, all of this, and I'd be in controversy the whole time, you know, in media stuff and all this kind of thing. So I would say I'm more to be endured than enjoyed from her perspective.
And your siblings?
Difficult also, because they're all private people. Like, my wife Deirdre is kind of just fasten your seatbelt and what is it now? You know what I mean? What's the latest incarnation of horror that we're involved in? And the kids and that. And that's one of the things that struck me out of left field that I didn't see about the book, that it did cause my family angst. Because I think, and I was speaking to Gavin Duffy about this, you might have a level in your life, Marion, where, well, that's a secret. You know what I mean? But someone else's threshold might be completely different of what's secret.
Yes.
In other words, not everything is in the book. You know what I mean? And so therefore, I considered this was what was reasonable to disclose. Some of my family felt, no, that was too much to reveal.
You crossed a line.
Yeah, exactly. And I regret that. But I've read so many banal biographies, I wanted to do the reader some justice.
Did they eat the face off you?
I know, they'd be more upset.
Right.
No, I'm not the type of person to eat the face off because I eat back.
No, but you took on board what they were saying.
Well, I would apologise to them for causing them hurt. And actually, there's nothing negative about any of them. Mm-hmm. They just don't like this level of invasion.
Right.
Of privacy.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I remember when you, donkeys years ago, interviewing you, and at the time, there were very few Protestants in the Dáil. There were more Jewish people, I think, in the Dáil.
Mervyn Taylor, Alan Shatter.
And there was a feeling abroad about Protestants kind of keeping their head down.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they kind of were insulated in their kind of middle-class wealth, that they could afford to do that. And it's funny, I tell the story in the book. My grandfather, apparently one of Dev's governments, the RT programme, Who the Hell Do You Think You Are? Or Who Cares? Anyway, my grandfather, my aunt was six and she was in this private primary school and compulsory Irish. And he fought this and went to the local district court and got fined and appealed and won the case. So there is this thing in yesteryear, the Protestants kind of kept to themselves.
Yeah, but
I always got eight times more Catholic votes than I did Protestant votes because one of the first things you've got to do in politics is count.
Yeah, well, I mean, you'd have to,
or you wouldn't have
got in. But I remember right through all the stuff about contraception and the endless
the abortion
debates
stuff
on this
was rough.
And this and this.
That was the only time in my political life for 21 years that I actually felt uncomfortable, that there was a sectarian element to debate. Didn't feel it with divorce or contraception. I would be very liberal myself, very always, both in media, columnist, and also in politics. I would have always been liberal. Mm. You know, the state has no place in the bedroom. And like, actually, when I set out in my book, what did I believe in? I believed in the church having no business I wanted a secular state. I believed in the market economy, and I believed in creating wealth and then distributing it, and all about increasing Ireland's percentage of world trade and being competitive and all that sort of free enterprise stuff and all that. And the other thing I believed in was that, you know, the traditional Republican view of Northern Ireland, that there would have to be consent. And obviously all this sounds like so passé now, but in 1981 Garrett was being belted with the crozier. You remember all this. Like, it wasn't even, you know, the contraception issue and divorce issues. These were resisted tooth and nail. So, and you see, that's part of the problem with politics now. There is a broad consensus on a lot of these issues.
Well, there's a broad consensus on, well, it will, there will never, I don't think, be consensus
about
on the
abortion.
Question of abortion.
No,
I don't imagine that's possible for all sorts of reasons. But there isn't that much consensus, I don't think, in politics now. How do you explain all the support for independence?
It's protest. Protest, pure and simple, because some people, independence are a bit like what you have in yourself in the bar. In other words, they're different things to different people. But at the end of the day, there is an issue. Sorry, the party establishment deserve a good kicking. They've been full of cronyism. They've been self-serving. The Civil War. You know, I've said that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil should go together. Mm. I think there isn't a cigarette paper between them on all the big issues. Europe, neutrality, sort of caution on the liberal agenda, the economy, market enterprise and all that kind of thing. Social justice, a decent health service. There's actually nothing between them. So that pretense has got to end. But, you know, there is no sense of entitlement for the party establishment, and they're going to have to earn it. But at the end of the day, there is a difference between electing a good independent councillor and the team game of getting the first 15 for Ireland in the cabinet. And I think that at some point, people are going to have to think about that. I actually am agnostic. I'm not a member of Fine Gael. All my baggage is there for everyone to see. Mm. People every day text in and say, that the old blue shirt, there he goes again. But I don't mind all that.
Right. Because I'm reading a number of people writing about the anger in the country that manifested itself with the big march.
I think it's pent up anger.
But I also think
that I was even looking at it from my point. Like, if you thought you're going to have to pay €500 for water, on top of everything else, the big issue for me was affordability. And I think they've dealt with that. And I wrote some months ago, get a long-term flat rate and make it cheap. And I think that right. might work, but they left it too late.
Okay, right. I accept that. Just before you go, you had a really miserable time in Wales. And you kind of, very untypically, were nearly like a crybaby about the whole thing.
Okay.
Why was that?
Well, I think, and I see this kind of, there's some groups like Democracy Action and so on. You do get into a bit of a war zone of you against the world when you're in the debt sphere. And I actually, after I came back, I just had to say, you know what, Ivan, you're just going to have to let all this go. And I put in the last page of the book to try and be better rather than bitter. But it like, I know people still going through that. And it gets on their mind. And so therefore, yes, I fess up to that. And because this is not a normal experience for ordinary people to owe €3 million or whatever it is.
But
I maintained all along, this was a business debt. Like, the company actually owed me €161,000 when it went under. You know, and like, I could have taken money out to pay for myself, but I didn't. So, like, I regard this, like, I make the point in the book. Bernard Summers went onto the board of Aircom for 6 months. £1.7 billion of debt was written off, right, by banks. No one lost their home. Like, so if you're a family business, you sign a PG, there's one set of rules. But if you're a corporate, if you're independent news and media, if you buy Superquin, you know, or if you're, you know, Morin Hotel Group or whatever, it can be restructured. You know what I mean? So there is one rule for one and one rule for other. But to be honest with you, I'm over it. I'm just want to move on.
Right. Okay. And you're enjoying the broadcasting?
Yeah. Well, as you know, it's day to day.
Okay. Listen, Ivan Yates, thank you very much indeed for coming in. Thank you.